And that is what we'll do today. I'll talk a little bit about the period that we're entering into and using the film to understand. And then we'll just go through the film, just speed through it and comment over it and see what can be drawn out of it. Well, why don't I say a little bit about the movie to get warmed up, and then we'll come back around to it. It's arguably the best known German film of the post-war era. It is a film that received attention in the United States as well as the rest of Europe right away. Produced by, I would say, probably at least the most notorious filmmaker of the post-war generation of the German New Cinema movement, named Rainer Fassbinder. Well, this is, I like this. That doesn't work. Fassbinder. There it is, Rainer Fassbinder. And this guy was intense. Let me just put it that way. Have you heard of him before? What do you know about Fassbinder?
Just that he was very controversial.
Very controversial.
And he
yeah.
Lots of people.
Yes.
He work
right. Yeah. It was a intense scene. Really intense scene. Of course, Wim Wenders has made films, Wings of Desire and some other things that made him celebrated in America. But maybe because of his notoriety, but also the presumed genius of his films, Fassbinder is probably the best known German director of the post-war period. And let me just read through real quickly. He produced 35 feature-length films, two television series, one of which was 14 hours long, the Berlin Alexanderplatz that I gave you a little smidgen up, four video productions, 24 stage plays, and four radio plays, and 36 acting roles in his own and others' films. He died at 37. Yeah. Okay. So it's another one of those, right? He was in theater and film for 15 years, and he produced that much. So in some ways, I think. A tense creative individual that ranks with the other great German creators, whether you like his style or what he produced or not. And therefore, I place him here as another one of our authors, right, whose outlook is as important as any of the others that we've covered in this course or did back in the 19th century. But moving to the post 1945 period, it just seems appropriate to deal with film because it becomes such an important mode of communication. We could use some of the other important post-war writers like Heinrich Böll or Günter Grass, and I've done that before, but somehow this is the cinematic era, and it gives us an opportunity to take that genre into account. Now, not only was he an intense worker, he was an intense individual, and this gets a little bit more to the grist of the films. He was born in 1945. He actually said 46 later, for whatever reason, maybe to distance himself a little bit from the end of the war. He had a sort of strange youth where he was bounced around between his parents, but in his teens recognized that, so this would be 1960, that he was gay and had a very complicated sexual life and intimate life from that point on, with a number of relationships both with women and men. And and that is part of his creative impulse and part of his notoriety and part of the controversial nature of his films, because he does address the issue of homosexuality in sometimes cryptic but sometimes open ways, his last film, Querelle, being quite open confrontation of those problems. One can also try to read into other films issues of that complexity. And so he's very early, I would say, in the in coming out and dealing with those issues. So that in itself is something that is part of the post-war period. It's not something that was done in earlier periods. And the way he produced these films was through just unbelievable intensity. And to be around him and be part of his crew, he had a circle of actors and actresses, some of whom he had, you know, relationships with, and he was bouncing back and forth between them. It's, you know, it can even seem a little tawdry, but there was a circle of production people and film actors and actresses that he made use of, and they were just this team, this notorious team, you know, producing this stuff. And Hanna Shigula was his most famous actress, and she appears in a number of the films as well as the plays that they produced, and that's just an example. But she's the most celebrated of the actresses that he were involved with this Fassbinder flash, if you will. And a lot of these films are very critical of what they perceive Germany to be evolving into. And that's what we'll be concentrating on as we go through this film, and I think you saw it. But they are products of the 60s, we'll say. He's 15 in 1960, so he's 25 in 1970, and this film was produced in 1978. So he really is a product of the 60s and the early 70s, which in the United States as well as in Germany and France was one of activism and highly critical stances against what they perceived to be the materialism of the capitalist systems that were evolving in Europe after the war, which were triumphing in this thing we'll be talking about as the economic miracle in Germany. But they stood apart from that. Now, the difficulty for an artist in that position was they had to distinguish themselves from the system as it was evolving in the West, from this capitalist material system, but also find some space that didn't automatically ally them with the communist East Germany, the communist system to the East. Okay, so they're always looking for a kind of third way, critical of capitalism, critical of the materialism, critical of the greed and all of that, observing that that's problematic and reducing people into cold, hard, earning machines, as we see in this film. But at the same time, not opening themselves to accusations that they were supportive of the totalitarian systems on the other side of the wall, or whatever kind of language could be used to describe them. So we'll be talking about the other side of the wall next week, but we need to know that that's there, because Fassbinder and other members of his generation had to try to find a voice, a space to voice that alternative view. I don't want this, but I don't want that either. And in some ways, that's been the driving problem for the German left throughout the post-war period. The left is still around, but it has to decide whether or not it's going to cooperate with a kind of a liberal democratic society that's established right after the war, but on the basis of capitalist economic policies, fueled and intensified by American pressure and American support in order to build a bulwark against communism. And that's really what the Social Democratic Party as a whole has done and transformed itself from a revolutionary party into what we would really think of as the Democrats, which don't question the system at all but look for efforts to make it fairer for the general population to the extent that it can. But these people weren't interested in even that amount of cooperation. And although I don't want to directly associate Fassbinder because it wouldn't be fair, but he's certainly part of the general tendency that did extend to the extremes of terrorism in the 70s. The German scene experienced a wave of what was known as Red Terror from intense anti-capitalist environmentalist movements, most famously being the Baader-Meinhof gang, Baader-Meinhof, which was responsible for some explosions and some assassinations of corporate leaders, and were ultimately arrested and then committed suicide in incarceration after that. So that fed a sense of injustice, and that they had actually been murdered in jail and so forth, which is not altogether missing in German culture to this day. You will still see every once in a while spray-painted RAF on walls. Now, that's probably kids who know about as much about the RAF, the Rote Aktion Front, I think it is, or Rote Armee Front. Rote Aktion Front, I think it was. Or Fraktion. I'd have to check to see exactly what those stood for. Who knew as much about them as they know about Nazis today, just sort of aping them and freaking people out by spraying that up, but coming from the far left rather than the far right. But it's still, an issue out there. What happened to the Baader-Meinhof gang, and were their intentions valid, even if their practices were excessive? You've seen it elsewhere?
Yeah.
Maybe there'd be, or maybe they're German spraying it all over the place. I'm not sure. I'm not sure. Have you seen it elsewhere?
I saw it in Rome.
Did you? I can't confirm this, but it could still resonate as a cause célèbre against left-wing extremists. It's possible. It's possible. Or it could be an Italian version of it, too. Yeah. Right. Using the same, acronym. Right. Another question? No. Okay.
Were these social movements precursors to what we would consider the Green Party in Germany?
Well, I wouldn't want to associate the Greens with the extremes that these terrorist organizations took, but it comes out of the same general roots of a criticism of West German capitalism, as we'll go back and talk about in a few minutes, linked with environmental, and at the time, concerned about especially nuclear power and nuclear arms. It was all tied together intensively with resistance to American policy of continuing to send in ballistic missiles, and you have to take that into account. Now, the Greens then have, there are different wings of the Greens, and you may know to a certain degree, here it's probably as extreme, the most extreme you hear about is Greenpeace, and they're kind of trying to block whaling ships and so on and so forth, but they're actually taking action. But the radical wing of the Greens in Germany and the alternative political, not blowing things up, not assassinating people, not undertaking kidnapping. Okay, so short of that, but staging intense demonstrations or intensely symbolic acts. Such as, I remember when I was bouncing around at your age, things like American generals appearing at some sort of television function and then having blood thrown over all over them. Not fake blood, but real blood thrown all over them. Or when the Greens first made it into the Bundestag, the more extreme wing was still quite active, and they just went crazy. I mean, they just came in with just, well, for instance, wild outfits, but flowers and strewing flowers and just doing demonstrations in the Bundestag, disrupting it. And what that did was just set them back in terms of election power the next round. So after antics like that, there developed what is referred to as Realo, the realist wing of the Greens. And that's probably closer to Greenpeace and the other Green parties that you may be aware of in the United States, where they're definitely engaged with the issues and want to do everything they can, and they might lie down to block people from going into a forest, but they're not going to do ridiculous things just to get attention or violent things. Right? So the party has split, and for the most part, the Greens have, as a result of that, become a much stronger presence in Germany, and of course are involved with occasional coalition governments and stuff. All coming out of the same period. You could say Fassbinder was something of a poster child for all of these elements, and you know certain aspects of his career and his personality certainly lent themselves to extremist interpretations. On the other hand, his films aren't quite as extreme as his own personality and his own story, because mixed in with this intense work, mixed in with his very complicated personal life, was extreme intake of alcohol and drugs, which killed him at 37. Sleeping pills and alcohol ended his life. But he was doing uppers to get going and drinking whatever he had to get down. And it was a wild roller coaster ride. So that all contributed to his celebrity as a vocal or visual critic of Germany as it evolved after the war, West Germany as it evolved after the war, his open homosexuality, his politics, as well as his lifestyle, right? He nursed all of that. He assumed what had it's to a certain degree it's become something of a. Or it had, at least in the 70s and the 80s, it might have changed a little bit, but I don't think so, not in German circles. But it becomes a kind of a cliched, stereotypical pose that was actually established in the Weimar period by people like Bertolt Brecht. Leather coats, completely unkempt, unwashed. I don't know if any of you, maybe they have some of these on YouTube, but Michael Meyer had it down when he did a skit called Sprockets on Saturday Night Live. He had had a German roommate back in the 70s or the 80s, and he just had this down. It was so funny to see him. So imitating this hyper-intellectual left-wing position. In a really absurdist way, not with the politics. But Fassbinder embodied that. I could click on, or you might want to click on and see some pictures if you end up writing about him. So anyway, there's a little bit background on the situation, generally in the situation, and Fassbinder's reputation as a really a fly in the ointment of West Germany. And that's the way he perceived himself, sort of like Socrates, but a very 70s and 80s German version of it. Irritating. He says, I'm an irritant. And this film that we're going to go through again here is definitely an example of his effort to irritate and critique and zap aspects of West German society. So we're getting a critical view. I guess this would be the post-war equivalent of Heinrich Mann. Right? He's looking at Maria Braun as a symbol for a kind of Germany that's evolving that he doesn't like, just as Heinrich Mann looked at Dietrich Hessling as an emblem of aspects of German culture that he didn't like. So I think we could really correlate the two, and that's one of the reasons to look at it that way. So let's just go back for a second, talk a little bit about the political system or the political situation that's evolved, at least to the beginning of the movie, which isn't dealing with the 70s. It's going back and dealing with the post-war period from 1945 till, I believe, 1964 is when it ends. Of course, it's symbolic of Fassbinder's attitude toward the whole thing, but it actually is dealing with cultural references to that immediate post-war period. So let's go back and trace some of the background to that. The situation in which Germans found themselves at the end of the Second World War is referred to in German as Stunde Null, or zero hour. Everything flat. Everything has been destroyed. And of course, that most obviously applies to the material conditions and the political conditions in Germany. The fact that cities have been bombed to the extent that they have, that the infrastructure has been destroyed. Obviously, they're occupied by Russian, French, British, and American forces. There's no currency initially. There's no transportation system to be, that's really functioning. I'm just looking at some of the things that Orlo reminds us about. Their diet was actually below subsistence levels on the average, right? So all the physical aspects of this devastation is obviously symbolized for that notion of zero hour, but also morally, of course. They have completely bankrupted themselves morally as a result of the policies of the Third Reich that we talked about 2 weeks ago. So they're not complaining when they refer to that. They're just saying, we were at zero. There was nothing. And they had to start from the very beginning again. Now, of course, starting didn't mean that the Germans were just unleashed to do what they wanted to do. They were under the control of the Allied forces. And that's really the story in the evolution of the division of Germany into East and West. And what the West becomes is a result of those pressures. The problem is that there is no plan, no specific plan for what will be done with Germany other than their complete destruction. Their complete defeat and, I've lost the term I was looking for, unconditional surrender. Okay. And when those things are achieved, actually, to a certain degree, their initial policies don't differ that much. It is to basically eradicate Germany. The American and British version of that was referred to as the Morgenthau Plan. Morgenthau, since I don't have a marker, Morgenthau. And I'll just read what Orlo says about that. Only the country's territorial dismemberment and political and economic impotence would assure future peace. Germany was to become, quote, a country primarily agricultural and pastoral in character. That was Roosevelt's and Truman's plan for the initial plan for Germany. It was simply going to be never be allowed to industrialize again. Never allowed to economize, never allowed to militarize and become a modern state. Literally moved back into something like a rural 19th century or even earlier. That's what they envisioned. Now, the results of the Soviet attitudes were pretty much the same, but it was just more practical. You are going to pay for what you wrought on us. And that was going to be taken in the form of reparations, and those were just started immediately. As soon as the hostilities, well, actually, as soon as they crossed the German border, they just started sending stuff back to Russia, okay? Whatever they got their hands on. Factories, trains, automobiles, trees, whatever natural resources they could get their hands on. And that doesn't end really, through the most of the Soviet era, East Germany is completely denuded of whatever resources it had. And that's, to a certain degree, why East Germany suffered from so much shortage and had such a difficulty competing materially with the West, which is the big story when it comes to reunification. I mean, they wanted to come over here in order to get the products that they didn't have over there. And I'll tell you more about this, but it was even in the paper. Even the paper. You knew you were in the East because they were having to reuse paper, and the paper was just this, it was, I don't know if you guys even remember, but maybe when you were kindergartners, they gave you this really rough paper where you actually sort of find wood chips in there with big blue lines on it. That's why all the paper was there, right? And you were constantly, you know, using this recycled paper that had been done because all the trees were gone. And I can't remember what exactly the materials are, but this is why it was so gray. They were taking out the materials that were necessary for creating paint. So they had no paint to paint their houses. Now you go to East Germany and in the more prosperous towns, it's beautiful, shining, everything's been repainted. But at the time, it was all very gray, and it looked like it did in 1945 because they couldn't produce paint. That wasn't something that they could use their resources for. And in large part, this is because Russians were taking that back, extracting their reparations right from the start. Now, the transition took place when it was clear that the Soviets were going to continue this and not alter their approach. They perceived Nazism as having been a facade for capitalism. Okay, this was the Marxist interpretation of Nazism and fascism until 1989. Okay. So they were theoretically inclined to make sure that capitalism was not going to take root in especially in the occupied zones in the East or the West, but certainly within the East. And what happens is that over time, the Americans recognized this and intended to build a buttress against Soviet expansion into the West. And then they began to shift their initial treatment of Germany from this Morgenthau plan, which is not going to allow it to industrialize for other reasons, but begin to provide the resources, begin to allow for the development of industry, development of technology, and a market economy that would satisfy West Germans to the point that they wouldn't be tempted by the Soviet options. So overall, that's what takes place. The reason that you have this shift in the West is political, in order to stop the Soviet policy. On their side, keep them on their side, and if it hadn't been for Soviet policy, we probably wouldn't have had this economic miracle that takes place in Germany, which, on a material side, is very efficient and effective, and obviously improved the living conditions of those in the West, but irritated people like Fassbinder. So, most famously, the Marshall Plan is a manifestation of this. Again, I'm just talking over the top of Orlow's description of these, so you can find a lot more about this there, which to us, our ears wouldn't even sound like that much, but at that time was a tremendous influx of funds and economic aid of $4 billion to the countries of Western Europe. And it meant that the economies of the three Western zones would become an integral part of the Western economic system. And just because he comes up here in the text and he is so symbolic of this period, the German economic minister who negotiates this and manages the German economy as the Marshall Plan is constructed and develops this free market system, this was named Ludwig Erhard, Ludwig E-R-H-A-R-D. And he became the, obviously the political, but even the physical symbol of this transition. His motto was Wohlfahrt für alle, so prosperity for everyone, W-O-H-L-F-A-H-R-T, Wohlfahrt für alle, F-U-R-A-L-L-E. That was his, actually it was later when he actually becomes prime minister, but he pressed for eliminating all economic controls, eliminating the ration, eliminating the state involvement with the economy, opening up the state or the system, allowing for free production, and obviously, basically, allowing the companies to do what they wanted to. And at that time, it was really a trickle-down, what we would, in the Reagan era, sort of Reaganomics, trickle-down system. It did progress intensively. So through the 60s, it did trickle down. But it wasn't able to maintain that kind of intensity. So in the 70s, when Fassbinder and these radicals are active, things weren't trickling down as much. Things come to something of a standstill with the gas crisis, oil crisis of that period, and so forth. So you can see economically how it worked for that first phase into the 60s, into the early 70s, and then it stagnated. And the trickling down slowed to a certain degree. But anyway, Ludwig Erhard he's this big, jowly guy and had always had a big cigar. And he just sort of, he's right out of a George Gosch caricature of a big corporate kind of interest individual. So he was the real emblem of all of that. Okay, we'll be talking about the East more next time, but probably the most famous manifestation of all of this was the Berlin blockade, which took place in 48, 49. And that was triggered by this economic policy. What happens in the West is that they establish a new currency. They establish a new mark as part of this policy. And the Russians were infuriated by this. They recognized that that was going to inhibit trade between the two zones and that the West was moving in a different direction economically. And that's why they closed off Berlin. I assume most of you are aware that Berlin is in the middle of what was the Soviet occupied territory. And the only way that you could get there were through three corridors from the south, the west, and a little bit from the northwest. Okay? So there were train, automobile, and air corridors through Russian Soviet-controlled territory into Berlin. And that's the only way things could go in and out. And what they did was to close off the land access, the trains and the roads. Okay? And that we were just going to starve out Berlin in response to this currency reform, right? Which was really symbolic of the whole transition, the whole strategy that the West was undertaking to create a thriving market economy in the West in order to thwart any efforts of the Soviets to expand their influence or to influence, let's say, a Western left-wing movement, perhaps headed by the SPD, to ultimately collaborate with them. I mean, that might have been the more subtle version of this. Of course, tensions were high. There was a possibility of the tanks rolling at any time, and that's something we lived with, and you did a little bit until
1999. Until this currency reform,
yeah.
West and East Germany
using
the same currency?
I think so, yeah, right. But you'd have to look at Orlo to get all that, you know, kind of detail to see actually how the currency worked and what the differences were. But yes, I think there was all sorts of exchange going on between the zones. I mean, originally, as Orlo says, it's cigarettes, right? But yeah, up to that point.
It didn't describe it. It just said, like, they changed, like, the new currency and described, like, what the old one was.
Right, right. So this was a, you know, really symbolic of the shift that had taken place, and that's why the stakes were so high. And of course, this is a very famous period in American German, West German, but especially American Berlin relations, because we mounted this effort to fly in all the materials that would be necessary for Berliners to survive this blockade. And hundreds of planes flew in every day, if not thousands, in order to keep that city supplied. And a number of pilots lost their lives in the effort. There were crashes and a few mishaps and so forth. But Berliners would, true Berliners who grew up in that era never forgot the fact that they were supported in that way. And kids who grew up then just worshipped American air power, American air pilots and so forth, because there were famous instances of them throwing candy out. So the kids would all wait out there where the planes were coming in, and you know, the pilots would throw candy out the windows as they flew in. And to this day, I think, you know, you'll find that there's a different attitude among Berliners versus the United States, West Berliners, who grew up during that period, and any other parts of the German territory. Okay, then just a little bit more background, because it pertains to the era that's described here. After 48, 49, there is establishment of a West German constitution, the basic law, which is the system which still exists in Germany, and that constitution was expanded to include the whole of the what's now known as the Berlin Republic. And it was very similar to the Weimar Constitution in terms of the liberties that it allowed. But there were two major differences that Orlow underscores, and they are important, not so much because they tell us about this period, but they do tell us about the mistakes that were made earlier. And that is that emergency decree, that Article 48 that existed in the Constitution of Weimar that allowed the president to rule without reference to the Reichstag at that time, was eliminated. So that's not a possibility. The president and the chancellor are not as strong as they had been in the Weimar period, because they recognize, this is legal recognition that the Nazis had come to power through that loophole, and that had to be stopgapped. And secondly, that I'll read from Orlow, to gain a seat in the Bundestag, now it's called the Bundestag, the federal council, rather than the Reichstag, the Reich Council, the Imperial Council, a party has to gain at least 5% of the popular vote in a state or nationally. And this keeps those fringe groups from getting in there and disrupting things. And I think that's why it was so shocking when the Greens did actually break through that 5% and were able to send representatives to the Bundestag, that they then went in and tried to disrupt things. I mean, that was shocking, and that really undermined that activist wing of the Greens for that period. So, because it smacked of exactly what had taken place in Weimar, and especially the Nazis when they did have, in the early days, when they did have very small representatives in the Reichstag, and disrupted things, right? Trying to undermine democracy that way. The far left made that mistake in the 70s. So two big changes there. Just a word on Konrad Adenauer, because, well, he's in the background of all of this. He was the chancellor through most of this period, and into the mid 60s. And I think he ruled longer than Hitler did. I think he even ruled longer than Wilhelm II did. He's probably the most important political figure in 20th century Germany, when it comes right down to, in terms of longevity and probably long-term impact. And so it behooves us just to know a little bit about him. He was a mayor of Cologne in the West. He's a Rhinelander. And that doesn't mean so much to you or even me, but within the German world, there are these divisions. And they have long memories. And the Rhineland had been pushed around ever since the 19th century by Prussia and Berlin. So he actually was prejudiced against Prussia and Berlin and points east. So the fact that Russia was in control of the East and that Germany was split in the way that it was didn't bother Adenauer that much. From his Rhineland perspective, he wasn't going to go too far in order to try to get those goddamn Prussians back into the German state. Now, certainly he had to present a good front, you know, that this wasn't an acceptable situation, but he didn't enter into any kinds of negotiations with the East. He would not recognize the East. He did not recognize its existence. Okay, he simply, you know, sort of wrote it off of his map and then operated with West Germany as it was. And this is why, for instance, the German capital of West Germany, once it's established in 1948-49, is in Bonn. Bonn is nowhere. It might as well be in Appleton, Wisconsin. That's the equivalent of... Yeah, I mean, it's just this very small, sleepy little town. It happens to be where Beethoven's from, but that, you know, even Beethoven got out of there when he was 16. You know, there was nothing there. But Bonn is about 25 miles from Cologne, right, and in the heart of the Rhineland. So this is where, we'll say, Adenauer placed the capital. And knowing friends who were who were journalists in Bonn and politicians, I mean, they were so bored. They just hated being there because of this tiny little town with about 10 restaurants. And they were happy to see things shift back to Berlin. But that was only after 1999. So his policy was engagement not with the Russians, not trying to negotiate improvement of relations there, but to firm up relations with the United States and even France. Rhinelanders have a more open attitude toward the French, and being right there on the border and having been occupied by Napoleon in the 19th century, there's a much, let's say, you know, it's not as though they're pro-French and they'll do anything, but they were willing to negotiate with the French, and that ultimately leads to what we know as the development of the European community, of the EC. Adenauer is absolutely pivotal there, and the German-French willingness to finally put aside their differences that have been manifested in 1870, in 1914, and in 1940 was pivotal there. So you don't have the EC without Adenauer and his pro-French attitudes in the 50s and the 60s. Okay. Just one more bit on the economy, and back to, I have more here on Ludwig Erhard, because he's so symbolic of all of this. He becomes the chancellor after having been the economic minister through most of this period. He becomes the chancellor in 1963, and this is when his policies really are applied, and the development of this trickle-down economy. But really essential here, and the movie does a little bit with this, but is to put together a labor management system, which was unique to Germany, and to a certain degree explains at least the social background to this incredible productivity that they had. Now remember, there was a strong labor movement leftist background in Germany ever since the turn of the century when the socialists were the largest party. So they couldn't just cram, corporate management policies down the working class's throat. And And remember, they have to work this in a way that doesn't trigger a reaction against Western capitalist policies and push people towards supporting something akin to what was going on the other side of the wall. Right? So they had to be careful about that. And what they established was a policy whereby, I'll read this because I want to get it right. Employees of all major corporations had the right to elect at least one member of the board of directors. So every corporation had a labor representative on its board. Okay, now that doesn't sound like that much to me because I'm, you know, not that economically inclined. But I've spoken back when I was going to Germany, and often with support or knowing people who had the support of corporations. In for instance, BMW and Bosch and so on, there were a lot of these people at the Goethe Institute, and they were always talking about this reality, the fact which to them explained why the German workers were so productive. They had a stake in management, they had a stake in all of these companies. Now you can also talk about just German Fleißigkeit, hard working, and so on and so forth. But if you compare it to the East, where essentially, when you go over there, you realize that you're walking into the zone of a 40-year sit-down strike. I mean, obviously, they didn't have the materials that they had in the West, and they didn't have the economic support that the Americans had produced. But, you know, they had no engagement with the system at all. Right? It was there was no enthusiasm at all. So this is an important distinction. At least that's the way it was presented to me when I was directly experiencing the results of this in the early 80s. Now, a big shift takes place when, in 1969, the SPD actually does get into power. And as Orlo tells us, it's the first time that a Social Democrat had led a German government since 1930. Okay, well, obviously, that period was the crisis period leading up to Nazi control, and then from 1945 on until 1969, the CDU, that was Adenauer's party, and Erhard, CDU, Christian Democrats, so the Republicans were in charge. And you had Willy Brandt, B-R-A-N-D-T, Willy Brandt, as chancellor, and then after him, Helmut Schmidt. And what's most important about their leadership was the shift in attitudes toward the East. They, unlike Adenauer, wanted to open up diplomatic relations with the East. The hardline position of Adenauer was, you know, didn't allow for any negotiations with them, and it meant for comparably strict policies from the Soviet side, from the East German side. But what Schmidt and especially Brandt felt was the possibility of improving the lives of those who were split by the wall. In very small ways, but significant ways. So what they started was to open up the possibility for communication between families that had been torn apart, to allow for visitation of grandparents, for instance. More telephone connections than existed before. Really small stuff. Now, in the long run, does Ostpolitik, O-S-T, Politik, did it contribute to the interaction between the East and the West that ultimately led to the realization among East Germans of what was over here? They have really been closed off completely. Right? But there might have been a relaxation that allowed for this relaxation, and the increase in communication might have whetted their appetite. Now, obviously, things that went on in the Soviet Union, Gorbachev, Hungary, all of that had to take place before there was a real breakthrough. But when it happened, it was overwhelming. Right? And what they were trying to get to were, you know, first of all, I would say their loved ones, if they were on this side of the wall, But they really knew what the West had and what they didn't have in comparison. And the possibility for listening to radio broadcasts, possibility of getting television over there, which the East certainly tried to control, but maybe as a result of Ostpolitik didn't control enough, right, or as much as they had before, might in the long run have ultimately contributed to the transition that took place. On the other hand, hardliners can say, well, you know, we kept, you know, we by holding the wall, by being strict with them and so on and so forth, we were the ones that made this inevitable. That's, you know, part of the historical debate. Did Ostpolitik contribute to this or not? You know, it's a controversial issue, I guess, among historians and probably politicians as well. So overall, what you have and what Orlov sort of describes is this capitalization, and some see it positively and some see it critically, Americanization of the West. And this emphasis on material progress, on material gain, on increasing the prosperity, as Erhard called it, of the West, even at the cost of, we'll say, some social policies, right? The rich get richer and the poor got better overall. But also some ethical and moral questions, because one of the fundamental secrets of the West was, well, if we're going to compete with this Russian worldview, if we're going to jumpstart the Western economy, we need experts. We need the people who know how the German world works. And that meant working with people who had been positions of authority up to 1945, and that meant accepting some, let's say, rather dark records of their involvement, collaboration with the Nazi Party, and so forth. And that's one of the dirty little secrets of the West, is how many people were, as a result of this effort to speed up, were retained. Whereas the East could, with legitimacy, say, we threw all those bastards out. Okay, right, but they didn't have their expertise. They brought in their Russian central planners, and it was a completely fresh start, which obviously didn't get as far. Right? But there are many, and particularly in Fassbinder's generation, who complained of this, the fact that many of these people were still in positions of authority, whether it be in companies or in political life. Okay, so some of the highlights in Orlow as in terms of background and the development of this West German economy and society. These are the things, I think you probably got it already, that that Fassbinder is taking on, the complexities of those. Now, the introductory way to read this film as a response to all of this is to follow Maria Braun as a symbol for Germany. Right? That she represents Germany and this shift. And the article that I've provided to you runs through some of those options. Can we look at each of these scenes? Because he's so explicit about certain points in German political and economic history, using radio broadcasts in the background, up to television broadcasts in 1964. You actually hear Adenauer's voice. You hear references to some of the policies that are going on there at pivotal points in the movie, right? So he makes it pretty explicit that what he is trying to do is provide you with a survey of German evolution during this period, right? and in the background of Maria Braun's evolution. And that she seems to embody some of the major issues. That, mainly doing what it's necessary to survive, and then doing what is necessary to prosper. And if you read that trajectory, which we'll follow more or less, the end is a very critical one. That this is going in a dangerous direction. Right? That that Germany is not going in a positive direction, and this could lead to some sort of catastrophe. Again, we know that the outcome is somewhat different. We know that the fact that Adenauer did start to rearm, for instance, that Germany won the soccer championship, and that the German economy was miraculously jump-started and progressed the way it did, hasn't led to the resurgence of some sort of German nationalism that has threatened world peace. Okay, but in 1978, when he made this film, this radical perspective on the developments up to that point was still concerned. So you sort of have to project yourself back to that point in order to appreciate the anger, or the critical perspective anyway, from which the film was made. So you have this representation of the shifting material conditions. One thing that I think I indicated in my notes that I sent to you, but is that you can follow, for instance, how Maria is dressed, or the conditions that she's surrounded with from the very beginning, where they're in this knocked out, beaten up apartment, and she's wearing very war torn clothes, to the end where she's got this new house and she has her very elegant outfits and is representative of this shift that's taken place in 20 years. Now the other themes that I have noted here, and that we'll try to get through as many of as we can as we go through, are the clear symbolic references to the either rejection of or the bankruptcy of German traditions, traditional values, traditional culture. This starts right at the very beginning, where you open with Beethoven, and that shifts over into the scene in their apartment, and then suddenly the Beethoven is cut off, and the radio announcer comes in and says, "We're going to interrupt this broadcast of Beethoven's music and to give you a list of the missing." So that's just one example. Another famous example here is when she's going down to sell her mother's brooch for a dress that she's going to use to prostitute herself, and some alcohol from her mother so she can drink herself to sleep, right? So very practical needs, right? Someone's starts to play the German national anthem, Deutschland über alles, and somebody complains about it, and the guy says, "Well, can't you even play your national anthem? What kind of world is this?" Right? So the national anthem is cut off there. Then she goes in to the black market dealer in order to, make this deal. Right? And that black market dealer, did anyone recognize him? That was Fassbinder, right, playing that role. Says, "Would you like these books by Kleist? I've got a Kleist edition from 1907. And she says, "Well, they're only good to burn, and they don't even give off that much heat," or something like that. So just, completely rejecting that 19th century romantic tradition. There are other examples like that. But that's another major theme that I would look for. Fassbinder saying, "Look, we cut ourselves off, or we are cut off from that past completely." Obviously, her increasing materialism, her focus on survival first, but then success at all costs. Perhaps a parallel to German willingness to do anything that's necessary, at least on the part of Adenauer and Erhard, right, to work with the Americans, to get what they can from the Americans. Is that somehow symbolized by her relationship with Bill, the black guy, in the beginning, right? Or at the beginning of her efforts to move forward? She gets what she can from him, but she doesn't love him. We get what we can from the United States, but we don't really love them, right? That's one of the parallels that's suggested there. But obviously, her increasing intensity here, increasing materialism, her increasing coldness, as she becomes just more and more self-absorbed, has to survive, has to gain more, needs more money, and is working this game between herself and Oswald, right, in order to achieve that, ostensibly in order to create a comfortable life for herself and her husband, the old Germany, right, symbolized by the fact that he's a Russian, a POW from Russia, who is incarcerated in Russia, released. Maybe he's a symbol for that old tradition somehow, that old male tradition. And in the fact that he ultimately has control over her at the end, is that symbolic of the fact that that male dominant former mode of German existence will ultimately succeed over this woman's effort, right? That's one of the complications that are raised at the end that people argue about. But anyway, her increasing greed or coldness or just obsession with material gain, right? And that lies fairly closely to an extension of some of the themes that I tried to bring out through Levy and with reference to the existentialist movement as a whole, but this need to survive, need to succeed at any cost, right? There isn't anything but yourself. You have to save yourself. You have to do what is necessary to get by. This is what basically she's arguing through all this. So it's denuded of any kind of ideological, any kind of idealistic vision of what could be. We're just doing what we need to do to get by. So those are some of the things that I tried to emphasize as I typed up these notes and that we can keep an eye out for as we go through.